Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Good Friday. I have a note here, actually two notes from the same person. Her name is Janet. She's listening in Madison. And she followed up with another note saying, I'm listening, which I think is her way of saying, are you going to get to my question? Okay, here it goes, Janet. I would like your opinion on how to reply to someone who says, just opt out when discussing sex education in our public schools. I think they are taking control away from our parents and teaching concepts that are immoral. What would you say to just opt out? I have words, but I can't take my emotions out of them. Okay, well, as I understand that phrase, just opt out, it means that if the teacher says, hey, class, guess what? We're going to do a class next Tuesday on how to wear a condom. Or we're going to do a class next Tuesday about X, Y, or Z, fill in the blank. And you as mom and your husband as dad says, ain't no way. our daughter, our son is not going to sit through a class on that. In the schools where this option is available, you can opt out. In other words, what you say is, my child will not be in that class. That's what I understand it to mean. You can opt out. It's your option, in other words, that your child will not be subjected to that. It's not always available as an option, but sometimes it is. So if that's what you're asking me, that's how I understand the term to be used. Now, this is really just an example of the serious endemic problems that we have with this sort of ideology and other ideologies that are ravaging the minds and the souls of these students in public schools. So it gets to now the question of, as you say, these things are being taught in public school and control is largely being taken away from parents. A lot of the parents, they don't care one way or the other. They just go with the flow. But I'm talking about parents who really care and want to stand up to that. Given the current circumstances, I do believe that public school, most of the time, most public schools, sometimes it's different. Sometimes it can be, you know, a very positive experience. Depends on the school and the district. But in those places, in those schools and the districts where things are just devastated by these damaging ideologies, the better thing to do is take your child out of public school and make some kind of sacrifice, if necessary, to send them preferably to a Catholic school in the area, if that's possible. And even for those people for whom it's not possible, the other option would be homeschooling. And I recognize that this can be very difficult and it's a sacrifice, but I'd far rather have to face God at the end of my life and say, well, yeah, Lord, we did without vacations and a nice home and other things that we could have had if we had the money, but we didn't have the money because my wife stayed home to homeschool the kids. So we made a sacrifice. I'd rather say that than to say, well, yeah, we knew it would be a sacrifice and the kids were being, you know, brainwashed in the public school. But gosh, we really liked those vacations and I'd like a new car every 3 years and all the other stuff that was really important to us. So we decided to leave the kids in there and not make the sacrifice. I wouldn't want to say that to the Lord when the time comes. So personally, I advocate that when you detect problems like this in the public school, more often than not, the better thing to do is to pull your kids out of the public school, take them to a good Catholic school, if at all possible. And if that's not possible, then homeschool them. So that's my take on it. And I hope that answers your question. Thank you. Let's go to Michael now in Tampa. Good morning, Michael.
Morning. Happy Good Friday. So yes. Quick question is, how did Thomas put it? Is it sinful? Or my aunt wants to collect alimony. Her ex-husband stops sending alimony, but she doesn't want him to sin because of how he reacts with regards to having alimony sent. So she's unsure if she should pursue court and try to get alimony or not.
There are a few different issues involved here, and one of them I'm not competent to speak on, which is the law. I don't know what the law in Florida stipulates on this issue. So that would be one question I can't answer. And the connection there would be, if she's legally entitled to alimony, then that's a consideration. She's not. Okay. So that answers that question. The second question I would ask personally is, do you need the alimony? If in justice, now we're not talking about a division of property, right? So that's already being divided 50-50. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. And what a shame that this marriage is ending in the first place. I mean, my absolute 100% preference would be to seek the restoration of the marriage, not a divorce. I don't know if that's possible.
But no, he's already remarried.
Okay, so he's off in the wild blue yonder. So the division of property has taken place. Does she have a true need for this, or does she already have a job? Is she self-sufficient? If she already has 50% of the property and she's self-sufficient, the question it would come in my mind would be, is it just, I mean, in justice, she may have a legal right to alimony. Does she have a moral right to alimony in justice? And that's a question I wouldn't know how to answer. I mean, she'd have to answer that herself.
Okay.
I'm aware of situations in which the one party, let's say, one of the spouses, winds up doing just fine with plenty of money. And maybe a new boyfriend or a new girlfriend, typically it would be a woman, and maybe doing just fine, and yet demands alimony, sometimes exorbitant alimony, from a former husband. And in justice, there's no real need for that because she's doing quite well. Thank you very much. So that would be an example where I would say the moral thing to do maybe to forego something that you have a legal right to in any given case. Do you see what I'm driving at?
And I do. And I guess that question can be turned around in a more massive scale.
Okay.
Is any of us do that justice? Like, do we need it? You asked, do we need it? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there could be that argument where we don't really need that additional assistance, or
right.
Do we?
Well, I can imagine a situation where the wife is left destitute, and maybe, you know, she helped put her husband through law school and he's a successful lawyer or something like that. And she's now left with working at, you know, at the dollar store because it may be difficult for her to get a job. Well, I would say she has a moral right to alimony. You know, that maybe during the marriage she sacrificed and did these things for her husband, and then he checks out, finds a younger model, and now she's destitute. Sure, there is a case that could be made in some situations where there is a moral right. In justice, she does have a right to it. But I was thinking more of the other end of the spectrum, where the wife is on to other things and there's plenty of money and she doesn't really need it. She's not destitute, but by golly, she's going to get that alimony out of her husband. Or her ex-husband. That doesn't seem right to me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and that's certainly not the case with my aunt. She lives alone. Her children don't help out much. She struggles. She works at Walmart, and she doesn't want any Santeria kind of repercussions from her ex's wife.
Is she involved? Not your aunt, but the other woman. Is she involved in Santeria?
Yes.
Okay, so she thinks that could come with a price.
Of.
Okay.
Correct.
Well, I would put it this way. I mean, if the other woman is into retribution and trying to harm other people in this way, as long as your aunt is close to Jesus and praying and living a good life and in receiving the sacraments, she has nothing to fear. You know, as the Bible says, greater is he who is in us than he who is in the world. So from that standpoint, and if it's an electronic, you know, entry into her checking account once a month for X number of dollars, there's no way Santeria can attach to that. You know, so
okay.
I don't think that in itself would be, for me, if I were giving her advice, I don't think that would be a barrier to receiving the help that she may justly be deserving of. Especially if her ex-husband is now gallivanting and she's working at Kmart, barely making ends meet, that's not right.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. And a happy and blessed Holy Week to you. That's difficult, that's for sure. How about Aaron in Michigan? Good morning, Aaron.
Morning, Patrick. Thank you so much for taking my call.
I'm happy to.
Yeah, so my question is, I'm not Catholic, but I aspire to be. I think the Holy Spirit's been dropping hints to me to look into my faith and see what it is I truly believe. And that was about 5 years ago. And I think now for at least the last year, I've been more than ever considering becoming Catholic. And the problem I face right now, though, is my wife's not Catholic. I'm married. Okay. I have three kids. And she's vehemently, I don't know if I should say vehemently, I shouldn't speak ill, but she's very against my becoming Catholic. And I would hate to cause a rupture in my marriage, but I also feel like postponing my conversion almost feels like disobedience to God. And I am just looking for advice here. I know others have gone through it.
Yes. Yes. This is a very delicate situation, and I'm first of all, Aaron, I want to affirm these intuitions that you're feeling, and I'm not surprised, especially if you've been listening to Relevant Radio for a time. I could see why you're feeling drawn. So let yourself be drawn and don't resist or don't dig your heels in. But at the same time, I recognize how delicate this is if your wife has told you that she doesn't want you to become Catholic. Now, has she told you why, or is it just an attitude of hers?
It's almost like a don't bring it up sort of thing. I don't know if she's like anti-Catholic in any way. Like, she doesn't tell me why. It's basically like anything but that. And I don't know what that's all about. Like, I don't know if there's something specific. I don't think she was raised in an anti-Catholic home, but
does she have any faith background at all?
Oh, she is. Yeah, she is. She's Christian.
What kind?
Was raised more in like that kind of non-denominational kind of like laissez-faire, church services. I think she mostly went to like Presbyterian or Methodist when she was growing up.
Okay.
So that's sort of her stripe.
Well, there is a distinct animus against Catholic, well, really against the Catholic Church, and by extension, I guess, Catholics, among the Reformed churches. So maybe more blatantly in like the Reformed Baptists, for example, and that's a tiny little subgroup of a subgroup, but within Calvinism, there tends to be a very strident opposition to the Catholic Church. It's not uncommon. Interestingly, we see many Calvinists convert to the Catholic Church, which is great. But I also wonder if maybe there's a Baptist background there, because also this is a phenomenon among Baptists. There's like a very strong, almost hardwired antipathy toward the Catholic Church. Like anything but Catholic. If you want to be a Lutheran, great. If you want to be a Methodist, great. You want to be, I guess, if you want to be a Presbyterian, great. But by all means, do not become a Catholic, because that's like over the edge. It sounds kind of like that's where she's coming from.
And the funny thing is, too, I think I'm more from been looking into my history and my upbringing. I think I was definitely raised more in the Baptist tradition anyway. And so it's funny that I actually have come around.
Yeah, I can only imagine the journey you've been on. So my thought would be simply this, that number one, allow God to continue drawing you, follow your intuitions, keep learning about the Catholic faith, keep listening, obviously. I want to encourage you to continue doing all those things. And comes a time where either one of two things will happen. Either your wife's opposition will begin to recede a little bit, and she may soften a little bit. I've seen that happen before too. And what could help that would be if you were to give her a book like Surprised by Truth. I edited that book, full disclosure. But it has a powerful history of these testimonies of the 11 people who became Catholic in converting people just like your wife who are adamantly opposed to the Catholic Church. I'll tell you a quick story. I was in contact, back and forth, phone calls and whatnot, with a guy who happened to be Baptist. And he really was like, just like you, he wanted to become Catholic. He felt drawn, but his wife was saying the same thing. If you become Catholic, I'll divorce you. I'll take the kids. They had small kids. And she meant it. And so I told him I would send him a box of materials. And he said, well, be sure that there's nothing identifiably Catholic on this box of materials, because my wife will go through the roof if she sees that. So it was a plain brown box. and, you know, an innocuous address, addressed to him, but it wasn't like coming from the Vatican or something like that. Well, it just so happens, he told me, that either the mailman or the UPS driver showed up at his house with the box when he was out running errands. So his wife gets the box and she's like, what is this? This is addressed to my husband, but who's it from and what's in it? So she's shaking the box. She knows there's stuff in it. And her curiosity gets the better of her. And before he got home, she opened the box and it was filled. I mean, a copy of Surprised by Truth was in there and CDs and whatever else I sent. So he gets home half an hour later and he can't find her. She's locked herself in the bedroom and she's screaming at him through the bedroom door. That's it. I'm leaving you. I found out what's in this box and you're obviously going behind my back and you're trying to become Catholic and that's it. I'm taking the kids. I'm divorcing you. And she didn't come out of the bedroom, et cetera, et cetera. So he sleeps on the couch that night. His marriage is crumbling. She wakes him up early the next morning and he's bleary eyed. What's going on? And she's crying. And she says, she's kneeling next to the couch that he's sleeping on. And she says, I just want to tell you, I'm sorry for all the screaming and all that. I'm not going to divorce you. I'm sorry to forget I said those things. And I apologize for saying them. And he's thinking, what on earth happened? And she said, well, I was so furious because of your going behind my back with this Catholic stuff. I locked myself in the room. It must have been after dinner. I don't know, but the way he explained it to me, she stayed in the room all night. So she said, I was in the room and I was getting bored. There was nothing to do. So she said, I realized I locked myself in the room with the box and the stuff in the box. So she sat down and not having anything else to do, she read that book, Surprised by Truth. And she had a massive turnaround. And that's why she said what she said early the next morning. She said, I won't oppose you if you want to become Catholic. I don't like it and I'm not going to ever do it, but I won't oppose you and I certainly won't divorce you. Well, you know what happened? He became Catholic. She became Catholic. The kids were baptized and became Catholic as well. A very happy ending. And it reminds me of what you're describing because his wife was just as adamant as your wife seems to be, but God works miracles, doesn't he? So maybe something like that. Maybe give her a copy. You may say, you know what, honey? I don't want to argue with you or anything, and I know you have a lot of objections to the Catholic Church, so here's a book that discusses some of those issues, and I thought as long as I'm sort of gravitating in this direction, maybe the two of us could think about the things that are in this book. Maybe she'll have a change of heart.
Yeah. Actually, I would love to read that book, so I'll definitely find a copy.
Yeah, you can get a cheapo used copy online for pennies. I'm not trying to sell you a book, believe me, but
I've read lots of books,
so many miracles associated with that book, Surprised by Truth. You want to get the one with the red cover. It's the first one in the series. 11 converts give their reasons for becoming Catholic, and I'd love to hear your miracle story. Call me back in a few weeks and let me know what happens. I'll be right back. Today, we'd like to thank Rosario, who is listening in New Mexico, for donating her 2014 Fiat 500. Classy. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles, trucks, boats, and RVs by visiting relevantradio.com/car. That's relevantradio.com/car. Welcome back to the Good Friday edition of the Patrick Madrid Show. And since we are in Holy Week right now, we're at the very end of Holy Week, almost to Easter. Please note that we have some special Holy Week programming for you, including today and tomorrow, right here on Relevant Radio. And all the information is available at relevantradio.com. You can join Father Rocky for the remainder of the Holy Week schedule. We have Stations of the Cross today at 3 p.m. Central. We have the Divine Mercy Chapel, of course, with Drew Mariani at 3 p.m. Central. There will be a special Way of the Cross that you can listen to as well, and so much more, all available for you at relevantradio.com. Click on Holy Week, and you'll see all the offerings there. Please journey with us between now and Easter. And also, I want to mention that the show is going to continue. First, though, we're going to take a few moments and listen to today's gospel reading.
John, chapter 18, verse 1, through chapter 19, verse 42. Jesus went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley to where there was a garden into which he and his disciples entered. Judas, his betrayer, also knew the place, because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas got a band of soldiers and guards from the chief priests and the Pharisees, and went there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Jesus, knowing everything that was going to happen to him, went out and said to them, "Whom are you looking for?" They answered him, "Jesus, the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am." Judas, his betrayer, was also with them. When he said to them, "I am," they turned away and fell to the ground. So he again asked them, "Whom are you looking for?" They said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am. So, if you are looking for me, let these men go." This was to fulfill what he had said, "I have not lost any of those you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it, struck the high priest's slave, and cut off his right ear. The slave's name was Malchus. Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into its scabbard. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father gave me?" So the band of soldiers, the tribune, and the Jewish guards seized Jesus, bound him, and brought him to Annas first. He was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had counseled the Jews that it was better that one man should die rather than the people. Simon Peter and another disciple followed Jesus. Now the other disciple was known to the high priest, and he entered the courtyard of the high priest with Jesus. But Peter stood at the gate outside. So the other disciple, the acquaintance of the high priest, went out and spoke to the gatekeeper and brought Peter in. Then the maid who was the gatekeeper said to Peter, "You are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the slaves and guards were standing around a charcoal fire that they had made because it was cold and were warming themselves. Peter was also standing there keeping warm. The high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his doctrine. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken publicly to the world. I have always taught in a synagogue or in the temple area where all the Jews gather, and in secret I have said nothing. Why ask me? Ask those who heard me what I said to them. They know what I said." When he had said this, one of the temple guards standing there struck Jesus and said, "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify to the wrong. But if I have spoken rightly, why do you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. Now Simon Peter was standing there keeping warm, and they said to him, "You are not one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the slaves of the high priest, a relative of the one whose ear Peter had cut off, said, "Didn't I see you in the garden with him?" Again Peter denied it, and immediately the cock crowed. Then they brought Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium. It was morning. And they themselves did not enter the praetorium in order not to be defiled, so that they could eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and said, "What charge do you bring against this man?" They answered and said to him, "If he were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you." At this, Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." The Jews answered him, "We do not have the right to execute anyone." In order that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled that he said, indicating the kind of death he would die. So Pilate went back into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this on your own, or have others told you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests handed you over to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom does not belong to this world. If my kingdom did belong to this world, my attendants would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not here." So Pilate said to him, "Then you are a king." Jesus answered, "You say I am a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" When he had said this, he again went out to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt in him, but you have a custom that I release one prisoner to you at Passover. Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" They cried out again, "Not this one, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a revolutionary. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him scourged. And the soldiers wove a crown out of thorns and placed it on his head and clothed him in a purple cloak. And they came to him and said, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they struck him repeatedly. Once more Pilate went out and said to them, "Look, I am bringing him out to you, so that you may know that I find no guilt in him." So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple cloak. And he said to them, "Behold, the man." When the chief priests and the guards saw him, they cried out, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and crucify him. I find no guilt in him." The Jews answered, "We have a law, and according to that law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." Now when Pilate heard this statement, he became even more afraid, and went back into the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" Jesus did not answer him. So Pilate said to him, "Do you not speak to me? Do you not know that I have power to release you and I have power to crucify you?" Jesus answered him, "You would have no power over me if it had not been given to you from above. For this reason, the one who handed me over to you has the greater sin." Consequently, Pilate tried to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release him, you are not a friend of Caesar. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." When Pilate heard these words, he brought Jesus out and seated him on the judge's bench in the place called Stone Pavement, in Hebrew, Gabbatha. It was preparation day for Passover, and it was about noon. And he said to the Jews, "Behold, your king." They cried out, "Take him away! Take him away! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Then he handed him over to them to be crucified. So they took Jesus, and, carrying the cross himself, he went out to what is called the place of the skull, in Hebrew, Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two others, one on either side with Jesus in the middle. Pilate also had an inscription written and put on the cross. It read, "Jesus the Nazarene, the King of the Jews." Now many of the Jews read this inscription because the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and it was written in Hebrew, Latin, and Greek. So the chief priests of the Jews said to Pilate, "Do not write, 'The King of the Jews,' but that he said, 'I am the King of the Jews.'" Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." When the soldiers had crucified Jesus, they took his clothes and divided them into four shares, a share for each soldier. They also took his tunic, but the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece from the top down. So they said to one another, "Let's not tear it, but cast lots for it to see whose it will be," in order that the passage of Scripture might be fulfilled that says, "They divided my garments among them, and for my vesture they cast lots." This is what the soldiers did. Standing by the cross of Jesus were his mother and his mother's sister, Mary the wife of Clopas, and Mary of Magdala. When Jesus saw his mother and the disciple there whom he loved, He said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour the disciple took her into his home. After this, aware that everything was now finished, in order that the scripture might be fulfilled, Jesus said, "I thirst." There was a vessel filled with common wine. So they put a sponge soaked in wine on a sprig of hyssop and put it up to his mouth. When Jesus had taken the wine, he said, "It is finished." And bowing his head, he handed over the spirit. Now, since it was preparation day, in order that the bodies might not remain on the cross on the Sabbath, for the Sabbath day of that week was a solemn one, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs be broken and that they be taken down. So the soldiers came and broke the legs of the first and then of the other one who was crucified with Jesus. But when they came to Jesus and saw that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. But one soldier thrust his lance into his side, and immediately blood and water flowed out. An eyewitness has testified, and his testimony is true. He knows that he is speaking the truth, so that you also may come to believe. For this happened so that the scripture passage might be fulfilled, "Not a bone of it will be broken." And again another passage says, "They will look upon him whom they have pierced." After this, Joseph of Arimathea, secretly a disciple of Jesus for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate if he could remove the body of Jesus, and Pilate permitted it. So he came and took his body. Nicodemus, the one who had first come to him at night, also came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, weighing about 100 pounds. They took the body of Jesus and bound it with burial cloths, along with the spices according to the Jewish burial custom. Now in the place where he had been crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had yet been buried. So they laid Jesus there because of the Jewish preparation day, for the tomb was close by.
We are pausing to reflect, of course, on the death of the Lord Jesus Christ today, on Good Friday, and we are anticipating the glory of his resurrection on Easter Sunday. So thank you for listening to the Patrick Madrid program today. We have more phone calls straight ahead, so let's go straight to Patty in Santa Monica, California. Good morning, Patty.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, welcome.
Oh, hi, Patrick. I have a question. Well, I want to know your thoughts. I am an elementary teacher. I teach in a Catholic school.
Okay.
And I basically, I always do this every year with my students where I, on Wednesday, since we don't teach them Thursday, I give a lesson about Passover meal. And I set up a table and I bring the ingredients, and we use the bitter herbs, everything.
Yes.
Grape juice instead of wine, of course. And I explain the symbol of each food. And then I wash my students' feet, and then I explain what Jesus was celebrating with his disciples.
Right. So you gave them a, how could we describe it, kind of a, they could see what that Passover meal might have looked like on the night of Passover.
Yes.
Okay. So what is the question about that, Patty?
I just want to know what you think about it. Do you think it's wrong for me giving this lesson to my students? Like, kind of, you know, I'm not reciting or anything, but I'm kind of, it's a lesson that I'm giving the students.
Yeah. I don't think that's a problem at all. So given what I understood you to say, that this is a Catholic school, you're tying it in with the actual Passover meal in the book of Exodus. You're showing them, here are the foods. So I presume there was, you know, unleavened bread and whatever other elements. I don't know if you actually did you have a lamb there, like an actual lamb, or were you showing them pictures, or was it the actual food?
I substituted turkey, like sandwich turkey, for the lamb.
Okay, so it was you were showing them. I'm trying to think of the right word for it, but you were giving them a much more vivid and realistic explanation of this because they could see the food. So no, I don't think there's anything about that would be problematic. For what it's worth, Patty, I recall when I was in grammar school that we had a teacher who showed us the same kind of thing, and it made a vivid impression upon me. And it helped me to understand something that I only had heard about, you know, Passover, and I vaguely had an understanding of it. But that description by showing us the foods, and we got to taste the matzo bread and whatnot, I thought it was helpful. So if that's what you're asking, I don't think that was a problem at all. It sounds like you're a good teacher trying to really help your kids connect with the material. Thanks for that, Patty. How about Charlotte now in Mesa, Arizona? Good morning, Charlotte.
Good morning.
How old are you?
I'm 7.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'm glad you called today. So what's your question?
Why should we not play video games on my tablet on Good Friday?
Why should you not play them? Is that what you asked?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a real good reason if you decide to give that up as a sacrifice, because you know why we remember Jesus on Good Friday, right? You know what that's all about?
Yeah.
Tell me why. Why do we remember Jesus on Good Friday?
It's because he died on the cross for our sins.
Excellent. That's true. And you can only imagine how painful that must have been for Jesus to go through that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when we give up a little something, like maybe playing games on the tablet, or you give up chocolate, or you give up TV, or there's some little sacrifice that you make. One reason for that is it's a way to say thank you to Jesus for the big sacrifice he made for you and me, all of us. And another reason is to help to, how can I describe this to a 7-year-old? To help build up your willpower. Do you know what willpower is? Have you heard that term?
Well, I've heard it in
those
Frog and Toad story.
Frog and Toad, okay. Well, let me give you an example. Let's say your mom made you a fresh batch of cookies straight out of the oven. I bet you like cookies, don't you?
Yeah, I like the chocolate chip kind.
Me too. Well, so let's say your mom had just baked a fresh batch of chocolate chip cookies, and she put them on a plate to cool, and she put them on the table and said, Charlotte, these are for dessert after dinner tonight. Don't eat them. Don't touch it. Don't eat it. And I'm going to go into another part of the house right now and do something else. And so you're there by yourself in the kitchen with that plate of cookies. And you really want one. You can just imagine how good they would taste, right? So willpower is where you say, I'm not going to do it. I want to do it. I want to eat that cookie, but I'm not going to eat it because my mom told me that I'm not allowed to eat it because it's for dessert. That's willpower. Willpower is where you say, I'm not going to do something I really would like to do. So do you understand willpower now? Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
Okay. So what I was talking about a minute ago is that one reason, another good reason to give up, if you want to, or if your mom and dad tell you that you should, to give up playing games on your tablet is because it's a way to strengthen your willpower. It's a way to say, I would really like to do this. It would be fun, but I'm going to offer it up as a little sacrifice. And it helps you build up your willpower where you can say, I'd like to eat that or go there or do this, but I'm not going to. I'm going to offer it up as a sacrifice. And that's a good thing.
Okay.
And Cyrus, you're welcome. Cyrus is out of willpower trying to push me to a break, so I have to take a break, Charlotte. Thank you, though. God bless you, little lamb. I'll be right back. thanks to network sponsor PushPay. PushPay offers parishes a platform for tracking donations and sacraments, overseeing schedules, mobile apps to help manage your administrative load, and much more. Info at relevantradio.com/pushpay. That's relevantradio.com/pushpay. Okay, we are back for the last little bit of our Good Friday program today. I'm so glad you're listening. Thank you for calling in. And let's get to as many calls as we can before we have to wrap it up for the day. We'll go to Pat in Yorba Linda, California. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning. Good morning.
Yes.
I have a sister who has, she's always struggled with health issues and in her personal life. She's basically one of those individuals that never catches a break. And and we're talking about someone that's 70 and she's single. She's never married. After 20 years of plus years of not attending, you know, we're cradle Catholics, family raised by a devout, you know, mother and father. But she just fell away from the church. So it took me a couple of years to get her back to going to church. And I share, you know, everything about Relevant Radio and particularly your show, telling her, and she is a good person, but she's always trouble always follows her. Simplest things. If something's going to go wrong, it's going to happen to her. So I finally got her to go back to church, come back to the church last year. I got her one night so scared about the need for confession. She went the next morning, met with a priest. She was doing well, but recently, I just talked to her two nights ago. Everything is going wrong in her life. Everything. And she says, why? Why? I don't feel God's presence. I look at other people's lives. Why has my life always been such a struggle? Mm-hmm. What do I say to her? And where do I direct her?
Well, this is obviously a big question, so I wouldn't be able to answer it in an adequate way in just a few moments. But I can refer you to a book. And there are actually two books, both of which are excellent. I've read both of them, and I think they will both give her at least a good direction to think about these things. The first one is called Making Sense Out of Suffering.
Okay, Making I've heard Sense you say Out that. Of Suffering.
Yeah. Okay. Peter Kreeft, K-R-E-E-F-T. And the other book is by Father Benedict Groeschel, and that title is Arise from Darkness, What to Do When Life Doesn't Make Sense.
Okay.
And both of them, either or both of them, I think would fit the bill for what she needs. She needs some help in how does she interpret what seems to be one bad thing after another after another. And it may not, in fact, be as bad as it seems to her. Sometimes our perceptions are not always accurate. But whatever the causes are, these two books will help guide her not only to understand that and maybe make some changes, but also at the same time to learn how to be more accepting of God's providence that sometimes brings pain and difficulty.
I've tried to, you know, explain to her, you know, some of that, but again, she really, Patrick, I mean, you don't have the time, but she really has been one of those people that just bad luck follows her. If something's going to happen, it's going to happen to her. And and like she said, I just don't feel God's presence. I've tried. So she's
one thing that comes to my mind, I forgive my interruption. One thing that comes to mind is you might gently ask her if she, in that interim period, was ever involved in the occult, seances, tarot cards, palm readers, mediums, things of that nature, because this, what you're describing, it rings in my ears as somebody who may have a diabolical harassment situation, a diabolical infestation in her life. And the exorcists whose books I have read say that's not uncommon. So illnesses, terrible headaches, strings of bad luck, so to speak, things like that can sometimes be induced by diabolical activities. So if she was in some way involved in any of those activities, that could have been a doorway through which some of this could be happening. I'm not saying it is that, but it could be that.
Yeah, might have been as a teen, but, you know, she's never married. We don't live too far. I know you're from California. Mm-hmm. We don't live too far. She's down the 91 freeway. I don't see her frequently. She's really made a major change in her life in the last couple of years, uh-huh, where relationships were difficult. But she's really come around a lot, and yeah, she's, I just want to help her.
Yeah, understandable. So that... that's something that you can explore further. I would recommend a book by Father Gabriel Amorth, A-M-O-R-T-H, called An Exorcist Tells His Story, because he does get into that and how to recognize some of those things. So, worth asking her about. You know what she might say? She might say, oh, yeah, I never thought anything of it, but yeah, I did go to a medium once, or yeah, I did attend a seance once. Sometimes people who you'd least expect to ever have done that, they'll say, well, as a matter of fact, yeah, I did. And that could be the source of, I'm not saying it is, but it's worth asking her about.
Well, as children, I know we played the Ouija board, you know, as in high school, but I mean, none of us owned one. I don't even remember where we did it, but I don't know. Again, I'll ask. I mean, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yeah, couldn't hurt to ask. And let's hope it's not something, but that could be one way. In other words, it's a process of elimination. Thank you for that. I sure appreciate it. Let's go to Scott in Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Patrick. My question deals with today's gospel. Okay. Why did Simon Peter have a sword with him in the first place? You don't really hear about that in the other gospels, these fishermen.
Oh, yeah. He used that. I don't know that I would say it's common, but there are a couple reasons why it could have been, or why he may have had this. One is that they were traveling, obviously, all over the place, and it would not be untoward to have a sword in the case of wild animals, for example, so when they're traipsing through the desert. In those days, lions were not uncommon out in the wilderness, so to have a sword for self-defense like that, to defend against robbers, is another thing. But also, others have pointed out that it could be that he got his sword, or got a sword, intending maybe to kill Judas, because we know he swung that sword and he cut off the ear of the high priest's servant. So he was more than ready to use it. And some intriguing possibilities would be that he would say, "I will fight for you, Lord. I'm going to defend you." And even though, well, you know, all the things that Peter would say in his brashness, I suppose it's possible that maybe he brought it to defend Jesus against Judas in some way. So we don't know for sure. This is one of those enigmatic moments, and the commentators can say, I think it's this or I think it's that. But those are some practical things that come to my mind.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Appreciate the call. Certainly timely, that's for sure. And let's see if we can get to Caden in Utah. We'll have to be quick, Caden. Welcome.
Hey, thanks. So real quick. So my brother-in-law and sister-in-law are throwing a birthday party for my nephew tomorrow.
Okay.
And so we were just, like, me and my wife have thought that it's Holy Saturday. We're trying to have a nice Triduum and Easter and teach our kids what it's all about. So we're planning on skipping the birthday party, and we're just wondering about your thoughts.
I don't think that you're required to do that. In fact, I know you're not required to skip it. If your sensibilities are that you want to keep really quiet and prayerful throughout the Triduum, more power to you. More power to you. But the church does not say that you would be doing anything wrong if you were to go to the birthday party. Thanks, Caden. Well, God bless you. A blessed Easter.